This episode is brought to you by Hostfully. Using Hostfully, you can create a free digital guidebook for your listing so that you can save time creating a professional experience for every guest that comes and visits your spot. Learn more at hostfully.com.
Welcome to Get Paid for Your Pad, the definitive show on Airbnb hosting, featuring the best advice on how to maximize profits from your Airbnb listing, as well as real-life experiences from Airbnb hosts all over the world. Welcome.
Get paid for your pad. Get paid for your pad. Get paid for your pad.
Get Paid for Your Pad, episode 272. It's that time of the year again. Pretty soon, people will have to file their taxes in the U.S., and so I decided to invite Miguel Centeno of the Shared Economy CPA on the show. He's been on the show before. I think I get him every year on the show just to give us an update on how you can pay fewer taxes on your Airbnb income. So he was on episode 237. And in this episode, we're going to discuss what's new in 2019, a quick overview of the different things that you should be aware of when it comes to taxes. But we're also going to discuss some insights that Miguel has gained by doing thousands of people's Airbnb taxes. You know, he gets to see all the numbers, of course. And he's also bought his own property in Mexico. So we're going to touch on that as well. So it's going to be an interesting episode. Miguel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on again, Jasper.
How's everything going, man?
It's a little busy this time of the year, but like I was saying, it's nice to be relevant.
Yeah, you were telling me before we started recording, you were like, this is the only time of the year that people respond to my emails. It's great. That's just kind of funny.
Good to be special.
It's good to be special. I agree. So I'm glad to hear that you've gotten yourself into the Airbnb game, huh? Here, there in Mexico, no?
I just had to. I think I saw the ROI, and at some point it became difficult not to.
Of course, I can totally imagine. And we'll talk more about that later in the episode. But let's quickly start with what people need to know when it comes to taxes. You're the founder of Shared Economy CPA. You're the expert when it comes to taxes in the shared economy space and also in the Airbnb space. You know, is there anything new in 2019 that people should be aware of?
Yeah, well, currently we're filing 2018 tax returns. And 2018 is the first year that tax reform hits. So I think the last episode we talked about what those changes may be. You know, those were perhaps intellectual at the time. Now they're real. So the big changes this year, there are lower tax rates. The deductions have changed. So a lot of the feedback we're getting from clients is, why did my taxes go up? And it's because some of the things that many, you know, homeowners, for example, real estate investors maybe are used to deducting have become limited. And one of those things are mortgage interest. You know, without getting too nitty gritty, things like state income tax. So if you're in a high tax state, you can no longer deduct all those taxes. Mortgage interest is now limited based on the value of the home, right? So those are some of the things that are going to impact folks coming into the filing year. And it's important that you understand kind of the differences year over year. But generally, things have gotten, in a way, better for many folks. And the reason why is for many folks that have a business, there are some favorable rules that came out recently. And those folks in the U.S. that have looked into it know about something called the pass-through deduction, which is a reduction of your business income, including income from, say, Airbnb, right? So I think those are really the highlights. Other than that, I mean, the big thing is getting your numbers down, and that's a process. So for your Airbnb host, you've got to figure out, hey, what's my income and what's my expense, right? Because the big kind of takeaway is that you are not taxed on gross earnings. So, you know, if you log into Airbnb now and you go to your income for the year, let's just say you see, I don't know, 20,000 of gross earnings. You might say, gosh, what am I going to get taxed on those 20,000? And we get that question almost every day. And the big question is as well, what are your deductions? I have clients that made 20,000 but bought a multi-million dollar property. They're in a huge loss, right? I have clients that rented a cheap apartment and made 20,000 and they made tons of money with rental arbitrage. So the big, I think, kind of take-home point has always been the same, tax reform or not, which is if you're doing Airbnb, VRBO, short-term rental, the name of the game is identifying your deductions. And I know we spoke in great detail about that on the previous episode. So I recommend to all the listeners there, if you really want to dive down into the nitty gritty, we covered that. I think it was episode 237.
Have you? That's right. Awesome. Well, let's see. From what I remember from those deductions is I remember there's two really important things. Number one, that you keep track of everything and you have receipts for everything. And then number two, from what I remember, is that there's a lot more that you could deduct than you might think, right?
Exactly. And, you know, the question that we kind of start off every conversation is, you know, what are you doing now to track your expenses? And I'll tell you what the best solution is, but first let me just tell you what I typically see, which is I've got a shoebox of receipts, not so good. I've got an Excel list of everything I've spent, or Google Sheets, whatever you're using. That's better. And then, you know, I have a separate credit card or bank account where I charge all of my business expenses. And that's kind of moving in the right direction of where we should be, right? So everyone should have a process to track everything they spend. I typically recommend using a credit card if you're into the whole points thing, or a separate bank account exclusively for it. And the reason why is you'll actually see your deductions go up. And what I mean by that is that you'll be able to make decisions at the cash register, so to speak, as to whether something is business or not. So I'll just give you an example, right? So if I go into my local, I don't know, general market, like a grocery store or, you know, a Target, whatever it is, right? So if I go in there and I'm shopping for, I don't know, something simple for my house, and then as I'm walking through the aisles, I start seeing things that I need for my Airbnb, you know? Maybe there's a cool lamp that's on sale. Who knows? Maybe it's a big ticket item. Maybe it's a vacuum because you broke it, you know, doing that. You can decide at the register, kind of in the moment, what card am I going to use, right? Oftentimes what happens when you don't do that is you might just say, okay, I'm going to keep the receipt. I'm going to highlight what's for the business, right? And I'm going to come back to it. And guess what? Guess what percentage of clients actually do that at the end of the year, right? Go through all the receipts.
Probably a very small percentage. Many.
Yeah, exactly, right? So rather than do the end of year shuffle where you're going to try and figure out, hey, what did I do again? If you have a card, you can kind of in the moment make that decision. And guess what? It looks a lot better from a taxing authority standpoint. So there's actually a rule that says if your business expenses and personal expenses are too kind of mixed up and mingled, the IRS may come in and say, hey, you know what? I don't really know that any of this is business, right? And oftentimes, let me just tell you guys, the IRS does not understand short-term rentals. Like, what is this thing where you've turned your basement into a hotel, right? Like, is it, you know, are you a hotel? Is it a traditional rental? So, you know, I advocate being very clear about your business practice so that if you're ever reviewed, the IRS doesn't come in and say, wait a minute, you know, you bought a vacuum, that's on you, right? That's not a business deduction, where in reality, maybe that's not a great example, but, you know, maybe that thing was damaged by a guest or was overused because you're renting out, right? So again, kind of going back to principles here, make your deduction decision at the register and not at the end of the year, retrospectively. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, let alone, you know, what expenses I had in November. And the reality is a lot of people, a lot of folks are going through that exercise right now, today, you know. They're looking at their bank account and they're scrolling through, they're looking for something they remember in November that was a big purchase, but what about the little things, right? So again, just to kind of drive the point home, all those little things would be more easily captured if you had kind of a separate card. And then, you know, benefit from a review standpoint, if you ever are reviewed by the IRS or, you know, the state authorities, you can kind of say, hey, you know what, I did this very cleanly, right? There's no question. So, yeah, I think in terms of deductions, there's a lot of things that you can include. Now, you might be asking, what can I include? And I think you brought that up, right? Like, what is deductible? You know, okay, so I know how to kind of record things. I hear you, Miguel, but you know, what can I really deduct, right? Like, can I really deduct that bottle of wine that I left out for a guest? To answer that question, yeah. And I'll speak more conceptually about deductions. You know, and I think we talked about it on the other one that, you know, the real rule behind determining whether something's deductible is, you know, is it necessary and is it ordinary? And I'll just kind of define those a little bit further here. Necessary really means, does me buying this help me in business, right? Does it help me make money eventually? You know, and you might not think about that the way, you know, someone like my mom thinks about what's necessary, you know, financially. I mean, is having a nicer kind of duvet set, or having a nicer, you know, having nicer decor really necessary? You know, someone might say, no, it's not, right? You just need kind of the basics. But in reality, as you know, and as a lot of your listeners know, you've got to create something unique. You've got to create something beautiful. I mean, whatever you're going for, right, there is, you know, value to upgrading things in, you know, your spot. I mean, you know, it might be necessary to make some of those investments, you know, and that makes it deductible. So, you know, if you buy something because you want to create a better experience for guests, you know, even if it's a magazine subscription because you want to leave that out on a coffee table, you can put those in the expense category. The other point on ordinary is, you know, it's got to be something that other hosts are doing, right? So other hosts are not buying a tractor, right? So a tractor or a large capital asset would not be deductible because other similar comparable businesses don't do that, right? So those are really kind of the two guiding principles. There are some specific rules around what you can and can't deduct, but generally, if you stick to those two principles, you'll be good.
Great. Well, thanks for giving that overview. And you mentioned something about the perfect system.
Yeah. I think, you know, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, I think any good kind of accounting system has two things. One is automation, right? So being able to kind of delegate to technology or someone else is a big part of accounting, because accounting needs to be done at very least, like, even if you're, you know, if you've made 10,000, you know, on Airbnb and you're going to report this, you need to at least do this, you know, at least I would say twice a year, right? You've got to kind of review this. So to do that, I recommend getting onto something like Wave Accounting is kind of the free application where you connect that credit card or bank account to Wave system. And then periodically you review the transactions, you categorize them, right? But what's the automation there is that the accounting software can start remembering how you categorize things, right? So if you keep seeing Target show up and you've marked that as supplies, that's going to kind of repeat, right? And what's the big thing that everyone uses now? Amazon. If Amazon is a big place where you're getting a lot of your Airbnb supplies, you know, you mark that in the software, and then you don't necessarily have to repeat that every time. So Wave's the free version. The other systems we use for, you know, clients, once they get above that kind of, you know, I would say, you know, once you start getting larger, either you have more than one property, or, you know, you've got a significant amount of revenues, I recommend going on to something like QuickBooks or Xero, right? And the level of automation you can do there is even better. So you've got to have some level of automation. You know, we have a team of bookkeepers. You got to have someone kind of focused on that, right? So the second thing you need is some kind of understanding of what metrics matter. The big one that matters for us is tax, right? If you're making an investment, you must understand what the tax is going to take out of it. I think a lot of your listeners will know one of those taxes Airbnb might take care of, but if you're on another platform like VRBO, they might not. And that's the occupancy taxes, right? So those are the taxes that come off the revenues. So, you know, you got to have a system that looks at kind of the numbers that matter. Other things that I know clients care about is making sure that they're not spending too much kind of month to month. Maybe they're tracking utilities, right? We have clients that have a you know, $2,000 water bill because they're renting things out. So, you know, being able to look at your numbers over time is going to highlight some of those metrics that matter. But really, I think the best system is, one, being on some accounting software, and then two, you know, having someone, an advisor or a bookkeeper, that's going to be able to give you feedback on your numbers, right? You don't want to live in a vacuum.
Hi, my name is Margo, and I'm the CEO of Hostfully. We are on a mission to make local travel a lot better, and we're starting with digital guidebooks to make that happen. Using Hostfully digital guidebooks, which work great on any mobile device, on desktop, and in print, you can share important property information and local recommendations with your guests. You can also save time and create a great guest experience that each traveler will appreciate. Hostfully guidebooks are very fast to make, and we've included some advanced features where you can feature your custom logo, your colors, custom categories, and essentially your brand. Please take a chance to check us out at hostfully.com.
Something that we just quickly discussed before we started recording, which I found really interesting, is that you told me you've done thousands of people's Airbnb taxes, and you can see all the numbers. You can see how much they're making. You can see if they've invested in a house. You can see the value of the house because of the deductions. There must be some observations that you've gotten from that. Now, I know you can't comment on individual cases and stuff, but is there any information you can share based on all those tax applications that you've done?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, I mean, if we talk about it in the aggregate, I'm comfortable, right? But, you know, if we really zoom out, if we really kind of look at the market, you know, I'm going to say something that's not going to surprise anybody, which is, you know, Airbnb is a platform that allows you to undercut the travel market, right? And it allows you to make more than, you know, if you own a home, it allows you to make more than a long-term rental, right? So that's kind of a huge takeaway that is an assumption that, you know, I think everyone on this listening to this might understand. But for other people, understanding that, you know, the amount of nightly rate can be as much as a hotel, in some cases more, I think is a very important observation that the market needs to understand, right? And that really highlights that people really do like staying in a home as opposed to a hotel. And there's other reasons for that too, right? When you break up that observation by region, you start to see other trends, right? And AirDNA is great in terms of being able to look at what the market rates are by region. We have data because we're working in clients' tax returns, right? The way that we work is that we actually need the export from Airbnb. So we're using actual numbers, right? There is no algorithm. It's observation. So what's interesting to us is to see that, you know, I would think that a place in LA would do better than some place in like rural Utah, right? Just anecdotally. I'm surprised to learn that's not the case. I'm surprised to learn that regionally you have pockets that are not urban, non-necessarily traditional tourist areas that are just killing it, you know? And I'm talking, you know, 30 to, I mean, really, I have one client in kind of the outskirts of Utah, just looked at their numbers. I mean, can't speak to who, but let's just say it's significant, right? Let's just say it's just south of 100 and I've never heard of this town, right? So I think what's fascinating is that you're able to see traveling patterns that maybe you wouldn't see if you were just looking at the hotel market, right? Because there's no hotels there. So that's been really fascinating. And then when you kind of underlay, you know, once you look at revenues and you underlay what are the asset prices in these areas, you get a very important metric, which is return on asset, right? So if I told you I made 50K on a 3-2 in LA, you might say, Miguel, that's great. Good job, right? But what if I told you that house was $2.3 million? What's my return on asset, right? It's pretty small. Now, what if I told you that I made 50K in some small town in Arizona where the house was 150,000? Like what investment would you rather make? So what's interesting is that you can understand when you kind of look across the country and internationally, as I'll share in a bit, that ROA is far more important than average nightly rate or average occupancy, which is still important. I'm just prioritizing a metric here that if you're thinking like an investor, you want very high ROI, right? And the returns that we're seeing are, you know, we also have some real estate clients. I can tell you what kind of, you know, Jamie Dimon's investing in, and he's got an offer that you can't get anywhere else, right? You and I, Jasper, unless you're extremely wealthy and I don't know about it, we can't invest in these kind of real estate projects where you get a 36% return. We can't, I just don't have 500 minimum to put up, right? It's 500K. But when you look at the Airbnb space and you look at that ROA number I'm talking about, I mean, you're looking at 70% IRR, right? So I think that when you break that down, you know, you end up seeing a very unique market where a lot of people are not yet keen or up to date on how to make that investment. And I know who I'm speaking to, you know, I know how to make that investment. I know you know how to operate it, but it's been fascinating to see how that differs from region, because it's really, I think, kind of opened my eyes that it's not necessarily the high cluster urban areas of New York City and DC and San Francisco and LA that make the most sense. And by the way, while we're talking about that, I mean, look at all the regulation that's hitting those cities, right? You know, my heart goes out to anyone in New York City right now who's gotten a notice from the city on Airbnb, right? I mean, so just looking at where the return is, my punchline, if you forget everything else, it's not where you expected it to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it doesn't surprise me that much that you're seeing properties in smaller towns do really well, because mm-hmm. I think the big cities have kind of gotten a bit saturated, mm-hmm. But also they started charging taxes, and there's just so much competition. The regulations have popped up. So, and I think also, you know, in a region where there's fewer Airbnbs or fewer visitors, like you shouldn't just look at the amount of people visiting. But you also have to look at how much supply is there, right? You need to balance those two. So if you have like a small village somewhere that has like one small hotel and no Airbnbs, then, you know, you could be doing extremely well. And also I think that, you know, the house prices in a lot of those areas haven't gone up as much as in the major cities over the last, like, let's say 10, 20 years, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, I think there's also a trend of, you know, people looking for unique experiences, right? I mean, if you look at Joshua Tree, if you ever visit us here in California, Jasper, let me know. But, you know, Joshua Tree, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, clients that just absolutely crushed it. Property values were low. And people go there. I don't know if you know this, but, you know, I feel like half of LA goes there to get some kind of an Instagram shot, you know? So it's a high, my point is that it gets a lot of traffic. And if you look at it kind of 3 years ago, you looked at the ROA, it was insane. What happened? Over the last 3 years, everyone's kind of, you know, investors have kind of caught on, and I think the return has kind of leveled out. So I wouldn't necessarily do Joshua Tree these days, but what's also interesting, just kind of as a trend, also following, you know, year over year clients. And just to kind of clarify that thousands of returns, we have about 300 to 400, you know, Airbnb returns we do per year. So over a multiple year basis, it's a lot. But what's been interesting about seeing those clients kind of year over year is you start to see kind of the trend that, oh, hey, this property was, you know, a really well-priced low item. But in year three, you know, they expanded their model and they bought at 2x, you know, for kind of the same space. But again, I mean, they're still able to create a very unique experience. People are looking for, you know, that great Insta shot, you know, and that might sound silly. That's not a very good kind of account conclusion. But there is definitely a kind of market trend to have a unique experience in these areas where there aren't hotels, like you were saying. And then if I can just share, I mean, it's been interesting, it might surprise some of your listeners, the areas that have been really, you know, have done really well lately, places in Wyoming, Montana, even remote parts of Florida have done surprisingly well. So those are the areas that we're seeing with kind of the highest ROA. And then, you know, if you look internationally, of course, you have to be a little savvier, but, you know, I saw that in Mexico, which is why eventually I felt that I needed to make an investment there. So I have now joined the community here.
Yeah. So you told me you bought a property in Mexico. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how was that process? Was it easy to buy there? And are you already renting it on Airbnb? And, you know, how is it looking?
Yeah. No, thanks for asking. So yeah, I mean, kind of same observation where if I bought for the same amount something in LA, I wouldn't do nearly as well, right? So I had a client who did very well in Mexico, sparked my interest enough to do a trip down there. And, you know, looking around, going on tours with real estate agents, also having a very good time. I mean, you and I have both been to Mexico. It's fantastic food and, you know, it's very fun. Very fun place to be, right? If anything else, also, you got to have fun while you do business, right? So we're down there looking at properties, and we found a place, me and partner of mine who invested with me, we found a great beachfront opportunity, very well priced. We were patient enough, and we put an offer in July, I believe. And funny enough, right, in the U.S., we're used to kind of 30-day escrow, so we're kind of expecting the same thing. Hey, it's July. We're going to close, you know, August, September. Well, that's when I learned it doesn't always work the same in a country like Mexico, you know, and I speak Spanish. I'm very comfortable with kind of business culture there. My parents are from there, you know, grew up going there every summer. So, you know, it's not like I got duped, but it turns out it's normal for escrow to take 4 months. So we didn't even close on it until the end of 2018. You know, we bought it at a low price enough that it made sense to invest more, to completely gut it, renovate it, make it very unique. We worked with an architect and design company down there to renovate it. And the beautiful thing about kind of working internationally in the right place is that you can go somewhere where the kind of labor and consulting, you know, architects and designers and otherwise are also kind of cheaper than they would be here, right? So I think for something that would cost us, you know, over $100 in renovation costs with materials and labor and design down there, we got it to maybe half that, right? So it's not operational yet, but, you know, it's under construction, but the designs were beautiful. We really wanted to make it very unique, very special to Mexico, but also appealing to, you know, maybe the picky Western eye. So I'm very excited for that to go live, and you're certainly invited anytime you're in Mexico.
Awesome. Where in Mexico is it located?
It's in Baja California. So if you're familiar with Rosarito, it's just south of kind of the main cluster there. So remote, you know, we didn't want to be too close to the party. We don't want to be too far from it either. But, you know, we wanted a place that, you know, if you traveled with maybe another couple or even a, you know, a bachelor group, you might want to be able to relax away from all of it. And guess what? It's beachfront, right? So you can kind of sit on the couch and look straight down at the ocean, which is a something that would have cost me at least $4 million here in Los Angeles. I was able to do it just a little south, but as long as Trump doesn't close the border, everything should be fine.
Oh, the Trump and his border! I think I saw another news item about it. Some people climbing over the wall or something like that. Ongoing saga about the Trump wall. One more question I was going to ask you. To me as an outsider, it's just all entertainment. I mean, I know for you guys that it's a bit more of a sensitive subject. You know, looking from far away, it's just entertainment.
I feel the same way, by the way. I feel like, you know, the front page is a tabloid these days, but maybe for another time.
And one more question I wanted to ask you are there any restrictions when it comes to foreign ownership of properties in Mexico?
Yeah, there are. And, you've got to have some kind of legal counsel. You know, I think that was kind of a big lesson as we were trying to navigate it ourselves. And, you know, our real estate agent had an opinion on how to do it as a foreign owner. You know, and they have a structure where you set up a Mexican trust. And if you don't have, a national involved, then the trust owns the building, but doesn't own the land. And that's important if you buy kind of a single family unit development, right? Because we don't know, but for whatever reason, the government decides to, you know, take back the land, you've got to carry off the building brick by brick. So that was something that was revealed once we started working with legal counsel. Initially, real estate agents, right? They just tell you, hey, look, it's beautiful. Look at the view. What do you mean? There's no concerns. So it was very valuable to get a legal counsel down there. And luckily within the partnership, we have some Mexican national. So we were able to make the process a little smoother. But that said, we did purchase from a US expat, no Mexican ownership, you know, and he held the property for 20 years. So yes, I mean, there's always risks and complexities, I think. And that risk is the cost of getting a good deal.
It sounds very similar to my experience in Colombia as well.
Oh, really?
There's you know, a bit higher risk, and not everything goes as planned and everything. But in the end of the day, like, there's the opportunity as well.
Absolutely, and you know, it's not just, you know, it's not purely business, right? I mean, I'm an accountant by day, so I have my fair share of 8-hour days sitting at a computer. I mean, what's beautiful about this is, you know, it's fun, right? I mean, we're kind of working with different people. We've got a really cool designer, you know, really, really sweet gal in Mexico, you know, kind of very lively. It gives you a kiss on the cheek. You know, we've got a great construction crew there. You know, it's funny going down there, right? We'll bring like a 6-pack for the crew. Like, I'm just having a blast. It's cost me money. And I do expect the return. The market's good down there, by the way, just in terms of occupancy rates and nightly average. I mean, you might get something comparable to, you know, a U.S. market. So, you know, it's not all business. It's also fun, as I'm sure you agree with your property, say, in Colombia.
No, it was not fun at all when I went there.
Oh,
it was really boring. No, man. And Cali is a super fun city, and I had an amazing time there. So I totally get it. It's buying somewhere in a different country. It's kind of adventurous. It's fun. It's exciting. And that's the one reason that I've invested in a bunch of these countries as well. So. Totally hear you on that point. Listen, Miguel, we'll get you back on next year, and I would love to hear an update then on how your property in Mexico is doing. But I just wanted to give you the opportunity to let the listeners know that if they need anybody to help them with taxes, how they can get in touch with you.
I believe we have a landing page just for Get Paid for Your Pad. It should be sharedeconomycpa.com/GPFYP. Feel free to reach out to us. We're a team of about 10. We specialize in this space. Really, our goal is to add value beyond just the tax return, but completely understand that this time of the year, folks have that on their to-do list, need to get that done. Consider us a resource for that. But also, we serve as advisors to folks that want to get in the market or want to kind of optimize what they're already doing from a finance, accounting, tax investor perspective.
Awesome. So it's sharedeconomycpa.com/GPFYP, and I'll put all this in the show notes. Are you still giving people $50 off for their tax return?
For you, always.
Awesome. Appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I know it's a busy time. What's the deadline again for the tax filings? Is April 17 or?
It's April 15th. Yeah.
Oh, April 15th. Okay.
April 15th. But just to kind of calm everyone, don't be afraid to get an extension. But there are some complexities around that where I wouldn't necessarily wait, but I would definitely talk to an advisor about whether an extension makes sense given kind of the time of the year.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Miguel. And thanks for the listeners as well. Hope to see you back next week with another episode of Get Paid for Your Pad. Until then.
Get paid for your pet.